Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. You got my co-host, Dr. Carl. And for the 20th time, just kidding, I think it's the fourth time, I believe, Dr. Grant Tinsley is with us today. He is also my chief science officer, and he is sexy as hell. Look at him sitting there. Anyway, we're talking about some muscle, more muscle today. He is a body composition renowned expert, the greatest body composition expert in all the land. That's why I have.
I don't know if I can take all of these compliments at once. I mean, you got to spread them out.
This thing's gonna. This microphone's gonna steam
Spencer,
up. Right.
Spencer hopes to spread it out.
The reason we have him on is because there's some preliminary top line data coming out looking at semaglutide. We've talked about this ad nauseum on this podcast.
No, we've never talked about it.
About the supposed increases in fat-free mass loss, not lean mass loss. Am I getting that right? Well, I don't know. I never know what we had this whole discussion of the terminology. Anyway, with these GLP-1 receptor agonists, Dr. Tinsley has actually written many papers on this, and we've had him on the podcast before discussing, you know, what these mean in context. Well, because of these, you know, potential concerns, these big pharma, this one being Novo Nordisk, has combined these semaglutide, their big GLP-1 receptor agonist, with a few agents that block myostatin and a few other things that have other growth effects. And this one specifically was the COURAGE trial, is a phase 2 trial combining semaglutide with trevogrumab, which is a monoclonal antibody. They basically make an antibody that goes that targets something called growth differentiator factor 8, which people know as myostatin. And back when I was
I was going to say, I wondered if you were going to start talking about this back in our day.
Back in my day, when I was in high school trying to get absolutely ginormous to be the greatest heavyweight wrestler I could be and football player, I was like, everybody talked about blocking myostatin, and I was like, I got to block my myostatin because, well, quite frankly, I didn't apparently get the gene in utero that my brother got where he does not have any myostatin. He had pecs and lats and abs in utero, and I had to fight for every little tiny gram of muscle on my little skinny body. Anyway, jokes aside, there were some supplements back then that these people were just straight up lying all the time. They said they could block myostatin. I'm like, please give them to me. I'll do anything to have.
Well, that's not true because you wouldn't do dangerous stuff like steroids.
No, not dangerous. But they said there's some protein powder that has something in it.
They said you know there was bullshit safe but stuff
placebo,
that didn't actually
work. I will say,
work.
I gained a lot of weight because
you were working hard.
I worked extra hard when I took that myostatin allegedly inhibiting protein powder. So that's really cool though. Now they literally are making drugs to try to block it. Now, they've been studying them for things like sarcopenic obesity and muscular dystrophies and all sorts of actually like pathologic conditions where we want to somehow help these people gain muscle as opposed to like, you know, me trying to be jacked. So unfortunately, not all those trials have shown – people gain lean – you know, muscle, they gain muscle, but recently they've come out showing that it might not be functional. They're not really gaining strength, but they're gaining muscle. So whether people care about that or not, we care about the function in these people that have low amounts of muscle. So they thought maybe we should do this with GLP-1. And so here we are today. We're going to talk about another paper here in a second as well. But I said, Dr. Grant, can you come on and look at this data and talk about myostatin since you have you teach about myostatin and stuff like that. So thanks. That was a long intro. So sorry.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure chatting with you both. So this is super interesting. like you said, I didn't, you know, I saw some of the supplement marketing, but my first exposure to seeing myostatin just in physiology courses was, you know, when we'd be talking about skeletal muscle regulation, and we know just big picture physiology is about homeostasis and having things in balance. And we have, you know, pathways that suppress things or that are getting too active and so on. So I remember myostatin being introduced in the context of, you know, if you pick up something a little bit heavy, but not super heavy, there's some mechanical loading on your muscle, and you know, your body might adapt to that a little bit, but you're not going to experience like substantial hypertrophy from picking up some light object. Even those of us who intentionally lift heavy objects and try to have the hypertrophy as you described, you know, there are limitations there. So physiological limitations. So one of those potent negative regulators, so kind of preventing too much hypertrophy from happening. So negative regulator of skeletal muscle growth is myostatin, this pathway. So there are some, you know, documented cases of animals with myostatin mutations. If you want to see some interesting videos, you can look up Wendy the Whippet. So Whippets are like very small dogs, kind of like miniature greyhounds. But Wendy the Whippet is a well-documented Whippet who's no longer with us, unfortunately, but who had a myostatin mutation and was just super jacked. Belgian blue cattle are another cattle or another example of this. So essentially, super interesting. That background, I did teach this for a number of years in our graduate program in skeletal muscle physiology. So to see, you know, drugs like this that are combining the GLP-1 mechanism with some of these skeletal muscle regulation agents is really, really fascinating. And Carl has something to say.
I just Googled Wendy.
Did you just look it up?
And yeah. I was like, I'm pretty sure we've seen this picture before and we thought it was fake.
No, it's real. So they can find YouTube clips.
I gotta
There's like an Animal Planet little feature on her or something.
We have definitely seen this dog before, and I'm very confident we thought it was fake.
Kill you.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Everyone needs to look up Wendy the Whippet, and this is not fake. And this is amazing. All right.
What about the cow, the big bull that was like huge? Is that a real one?
Yeah. Belgian blue.
That's Belgian. All right. Belgian.
That's like when you try to inject the stuff into your penis.
There's at least one case. I know there's a case study in the New England Journal of Medicine of a child with a myostatin mutation who's like very young. Yeah. Oh man, I thought we were keeping it, you know, de-identified here, but I guess we're just, you know, blowing the lid off that.
Yeah, that's a muscular cow, Belgian blue. My God, what the heck is going on here? That's funny.
So we're not saying if you're looking up these images, we're not saying this is what your, you know, average study participant is going to look like after these trials, because these are extreme. You know, these are you know, mutations to the extent where there might be no myostatin present. In this case, we're talking about drugs that might be decreasing the activity of these negative regulation pathways in skeletal muscle or inhibition of the you know, the pathways involved there. So we're not saying that's going to be your average study participant. But yeah, this is super, super interesting data looking at this, you know, press release from Regeneron. So the semaglutide, and just for context, this was sort of the midpoint of this trial. So this was when half the participants in this trial reached the midpoint of the study, which is 26 weeks. And that coincided with the end of their weight loss period. What the data we don't have is they're going to transition then to the weight maintenance period, which is, sounds kind of interesting because it sounds like they'll be off the, GLP-1, off semaglutide, and, simply having monotherapy of one of the myostatin, inhibitors or placebo. So I'll be curious to get your guys' thoughts on that at some point in the call if we have time. But, in these first 26 weeks, they saw in terms of a percent of weight loss, we'll call it as lean mass. So I won't go down into the weeds of terminology again, but from this press release, and this is kind of splitting hairs, but not really, they just say lean mass. It's not clear if this is lean soft tissue from DEXA. It probably is. And that would be everything that is not fat or bone mineral. The issue is people also sometimes use lean mass to mean fat-free mass, which is everything but fat. So that bone mineral being included. Steve Himesfield and I have published a few papers on terminology, and we essentially discourage the use of the term lean mass unless it's just a very general discussion.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought that's what you said last time.
Yeah. So if it's a general discussion, yes. If it's a general discussion, that's fine. The issue here is we don't know if they mean fat-free mass or lean soft tissue. And again, the difference there is whether bone mineral is included. And I think the bone, I won't go on this tangent too long, but I think the bone mineral is important. And I think it's kind of underreported in some of these trials. You know, 26 weeks, traditionally, we wouldn't expect to see anything too meaningful happening with kind of a gross estimate like bone mineral content from DEXA, but these are unique, you know, physiological scenarios we're inducing. So that also helps the reporting be a little more transparent if you have the bone mineral, the fat, lean soft tissue. But be that as it may, they were reporting with semaglutide alone, about 35% of weight loss came from lean mass. So that's similar to what we've seen in the longer trials of semaglutide, maybe just slightly less. But then with the two different combinations of the myostatin inhibitor and semaglutide, it was only about 17% of weight loss from lean mass. So it takes us, you know, past, you know, where sema was, past where tirzepatide is. So typically there we've seen about 26% of, I'll just keep saying lean mass because that's what they used here in the press release, 26% of lean mass loss, and going even below that down to about 17% lean mass loss. And that was at two different doses. I don't know if you all have any thoughts on that, but the two different doses they were using of the myostatin inhibitor seemed to produce relatively similar results.
Yeah, I mean, the gist from me is that, like, I've seen Dr. Mike Israetel, he's talking about these things better than steroids. I urge caution because don't know are the long-term effects of what else could be going on. The other drug that they were studying with this, because they did, this is a part of like a potential triple therapy. The other drug was garetosmab. I don't know.
Yeah.
Which is an activin A inhibitor to block activin A, which is another pathway that looks into growth, muscle growth. But as those other trials have looked at, not with these GLP-1 receptor agonists, it doesn't seem there's any functional improvement from just increasing the mass. Again, in pathological conditions, it's possible that in these healthy, maybe it does. So it'll be really interesting when they start, I believe they look at physical activity and all the functional scores. So I think that'll be really cool to see, and maybe we'll be wowed. I assume that we're going to still need to actually use our muscles. Maybe there'll be a day where we're just like, screw it. We're just all jacked humans. Mm. And we don't have to do anything. I don't know. We're all going to be like Carl Nadolski Jr.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, you know, to Mike Israetel saying that better than steroids. I mean, this goes to what we talk about all the time. These medications are great for whom they're indicated. And that's why we have all of these trials. And these are only phase two trials. And so they're trying to make sure that they're safe, that they have some benefit. And then to what degree of benefit we find out in whom, that's where it really matters. So that's why people should not take anabolic steroids, or people who don't have testosterone deficiency taking TRT, because it's not actually replacement therapy, because the benefits don't outweigh the risks. Same with the GLP-1 receptor agonists. If someday, you know, it turns out that, oh, everyone should be on these because they're dirt cheap and the benefits outweigh the risks to maintain lean body composition and stuff and prevent disease, fine. Someday maybe we'll find that out. But I think your caution is very much warranted. And I will say that, you know, you talk about the different doses and everything like that. They at the end of the press release that I'm looking at, talks about severe adverse events that led to treatment discontinuation, I think, kept going up in the combination. So like 10% in the triple arm group compared to just a few percent in the single low and high dose groups.
But yeah, cutting without lifting weights, I mean, Dr. Grant and I are doing this. It's not a trial. It's an observational real world study. Just me trying to tell everybody to lift weights and eat a lot of protein. We'll see if it has an effect. Again, we aren't comparing it to a control group. So we're just going to kind of see what happens. But, you know, cutting the lean mass loss in half is intriguing, as long as it's safe. I think this one's a subcutaneous. The trevogrumab is a subcutaneous injection, where I believe the other one is an infusion. If I remember, I can look that up, but, there's some practical considerations there too. There is another one called bimagrumab, which we have talked about in the past, which is a very well-known myostatin inhibitor as well. That's going to be published here in a few weeks during the ADA conference. And I'm sure we're going to have Dr. Tinsley back on to discuss that as well. What,
and what's interesting, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Eli Lilly acquire the rights to bimagrumab?
So that's what I thought.
Eli Lilly, and yet it's Novo Nordisk's semaglutide being studied and presented at ADA in combination with bimagrumab. So,
yeah, I think it was.
You got me there. I don't know.
I think it was probably before that happened, I assume. So trevogrumab, yeah, is subcutaneous. Garetosmab is intravenous, and then I'm let's see, bimagrumab I thought was intravenous, but someone, one of my buddies, said no, they're trying to figure it out for subcutaneous, and yeah, they actually have both for bimagrumab, because that's, imagine having to go,
yeah, that wouldn't be very practical,
and get an infusion just to like lift some weights.
Right.
Again, easier said than done.
And you know, and to your point of, does it even matter if you have bigger muscles if they're not functional and healthy? So, you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of all the trials of the CETP inhibitors trying to increase HDL, the good cholesterol, and it turned out it was like, what did it, some of the lipidologists compared it to like a busy New York streets with too many taxi cars or something. It just kind of got all log jammed and they didn't work, basically. Yada, yada, yada. The high HDL didn't work, and people actually in some of the trials had worse outcomes. So if we get bigger muscles that are not healthy and they don't do anything good, then it, maybe it doesn't matter. But so that's why that needs to be figured out.
Yeah, it'd be incredible if down the road they can look at combinations with and without exercise, like if it potentiates the benefits of exercise. And maybe exercise alone would completely replace it. We're obviously exercise does a lot more than just, you know, this is, we're looking at this one pathway or several related pathways, but yeah, it's gonna be hard to get to the point, I think, where we can truly replace the need for exercise.
But I kind do think it shows benefit in type 2 diabetes. You know, some of the early phase 2 trials are actually in diabetes, not just obesity, which is where, you know, really kind of that sarcopenic obesity, the thin people with abdominal obesity, not enough muscle, and type 2 diabetes, they have some of the highest cardiometabolic risk, like heart disease and stuff. So if there is metabolically healthy benefit from that muscle, which it appears so from the blood sugar data, then that would be very important for those types of people. And I know we all see those types of people.
So, okay. So Eli Lilly owns bimagrumab because it was developed by Novartis. Then Novartis said, we're just going to license it out to this Versanis Bio. And then Eli Lilly bought Versanis Bio 2 years ago, 2 years ago. And during that time, Novo Nordisk is collaborating with the drug. Just that's kind of interesting.
Wow, that is very interesting.
That is weird. Anyway, okay. Anything else notable from this? I mean, basically, they're cutting in half. If you, the triple combo with the garetosmab caused, looks like, potential issues.
Yeah, more so.
They don't know for sure, but seems to be.
Yeah, no, that's the major thing. Obviously, it'll be nice when the full data set is there. It'll be interesting too to see that maintenance phase, as mentioned.
Yeah.
And we don't have to go down this path if you guys don't want, but I know you've talked
about.
Yeah,
what was your question on that?
Well, yeah, so I know you've Dr. Spencer have talked about this being the GLP-1s being like a medication you go on, and you've had some really helpful examples talking about blood pressure medication, other types of, you know, medications where, like, okay, who's asking that person on medication for the blood pressure? Like, oh, when are you going to go off it? Are you going to have to stay on it forever? So I'm curious your thoughts on this trial design, because if I'm understanding correctly, it sounds like the maintenance phase. Yeah, it says after 26 weeks. So this, again, we just presented the 26-week data that we're talking about. It says patients enter into the weight maintenance phase in which they receive either higher dose trevogrumab monotherapy or placebo through the end of the trial. So my understanding is that then no one, right, we'll be on a GLP-1 for that next 26 weeks. So I'm curious your thoughts on that. And we don't have to have a long discussion.
Or are they staying on the
semaglutide? Are they assuming, because it's possible that they're staying on the semaglutide. Yeah.
That would make more sense, I would think.
So that may be correct. This one, you know, you all know the press release is so short. That one sentence is the entire description of that next phase. So I may be misinterpreting that differently than they are doing it. I don't know if the full registration's up, so
I can go look at the clinicaltrials.gov. Okay.
And that's fine. We don't have to go down that road. That's how I was interpreting their phrasing, but that very well could not be the case.
Do you want to talk about the Surpass MRI data that we wanted to talk about it a few weeks ago?
That's a bigger trial and maybe more, you know, that's out and more practical for this day and age.
Yes. So the neat thing here, we've talked about, we were just talking about Dexadata. We've talked about Dexadata a few other times. Dexa, again, just in case someone's newer to the podcast, is dual energy X-ray absorptiometry. It's a very good imaging technique for total body composition. It forms a two-dimensional image of the body. It can ultimately separate the composition of these pixels based first on if they contain bone mineral or not. If they don't contain bone mineral, it looks at the proportion of soft tissues. So lean soft tissue, which is everything except fat and bone, mineral, and then fat itself. The thing we've been missing is actual like volumetric, three-dimensional volume, muscle volume data. And we can really get that from magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, or computed tomography. So yeah, this trial that came out, this paper that came out reporting this MRI component within the SURPASS trial, this was in type 2 diabetics, and it wasn't whole body skeletal muscle mass, but they did look at thigh skeletal muscle volume in the context of this treatment. And the loss they saw, what we've been talking about so far, just so everyone, no one's confused on this, what we were just talking about is the percent of weight loss from lean mass versus fat mass. That's not how the skeletal muscle is expressed here, because it's not total body skeletal muscle. They were just looking at the thigh. So really that you could look at the percent decrease from baseline. So they saw about across pooled tirzepatide doses, saw about a 6% decrease in thigh skeletal muscle volume. So again, these are muscle volumes from MRI. 6% is not particularly large, but we don't know for certain. It'd be nice to see the DEXA data right alongside this, because there is a kind of a variable relationship between how someone's DEXA lean mass would change and their skeletal muscle would change. There's some degree of correlation, but these are not interchangeable techniques because they're not truly measuring the same thing. There's measurement error and so on. But again, point being, it's nice to start to see some MRI data out here. From my perspective, it's not like a huge red flag on the quantity, but of course, we need more information on that, ideally with total body skeletal muscle, and ideally reported alongside DEXA, so we can kind of see how we should relate these data back to all these DEXA sub-studies we've been discussing over the past months.
Now, I'll say that, you know, SURPASS 3, of course, is very different trial than these trials in people with obesity without diabetes. So SURPASS 3 was tirzepatide in people with obesity with type 2 diabetes. And not only did they just have, you know, A1Cs of 7 to 10.5, so they had hyperglycemia, but they were also on metformin, and many of them were also on SGLT2 inhibitors like empagliflozin, dapagliflozin, Jardiance, Farxiga. For people out there, those are the medications that trick your kidneys into peeing out sugar, no matter what your blood sugars are. And so it is a very different patient population than people who have not, you know, crossed that pathophysiologic criteria into type 2 diabetes. So, you know, muscle metabolism is different and all that stuff. So it's not exactly the same by any means, but it's so you're, but the bottom line is these people are much metabolically in worse health. And so you're saying this is pretty reassuring data overall, right? These are,
I think so. I'd hesitate to state it too strongly because we don't have a lot to compare against. So like in our discussions, for example, in the obesity realm with the semaglutide trials, tirzepatide trials, now the press release we just talked about, we're accumulating enough that we're kind of seeing how these different therapies are stacking up. Here is kind of a one-off assessment. And as you mentioned, like in kind of a unique population as compared to the obesity trials. I don't want to over-interpret it and say like, oh, I'm super reassured by this. But at face value, for context, the loss of muscle volume was like 0.64 liters out of 10 point something liters they started with in the quads. In the thigh, the whole thigh.
Yeah.
It did not jump out to me as like, oh, you know, super concern. But, you know, we certainly need more data.
Well, and Spencer and I, you know, we talk about this all the time at nauseam, because all these people out there that scaremonger people away from these medications because of the potential, you know, higher proportion of whether we want to call it lean mass, muscle mass, whatever, they extrapolate to muscle mass. Even if it's true, even if they did have a little bit excess loss of healthy weight, the clinical health outcomes from all of these trials in those in whom they're indicated, again, back to whom they're indicated, they have better glycemic control, which leads to reduced complications from diabetes. They have reduced risk of heart attack, strokes, kidney disease, liver disease, better sleep apnea. And even if they are lighter with lower muscle mass, which I don't think that's truly the case, they have better physical function and end up having more physical activity and thus better health. So, you know, does it even, you know, and heart failure, I didn't even mention that. So I don't know. So sometimes I feel like, you know, these rabbit holes people are so worried about, and we need everyone to lift weights anyways. So we got to do that. We got to exercise, and these medications have actual clinical benefits, even if those were concerns.
Yeah. I've made some funny Twitter posts about that. Oh no, you lost some a little bit more muscle than you thought. But you also lost, you know, you also prevented heart attack, strokes, kidney disease, all these different things. And then you got the other people like, I guess I'm not going to prevent a heart attack because I'm worried about losing a little bit extra muscle. Even if that were the case, I actually don't think it's
right,
the case. Yeah.
And they're exercising more, by the way, because as their weight goes down, suddenly they're exercising more.
They feel so much better. So yeah. it's just myopic.
Maybe it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, it just doesn't matter. Very good, Dr. Tinsley. Anything else notable about this?
Based on the press release, no, it's very succinct, you know, so it reads nicely, very interesting. It'll be nice to see the full data set when that's available, the full publication, full details and so on. But at face value, super interesting. As you all mentioned, I think there's a missing component, you know, from the press release that we'll need to look at with physical function, implications for exercise involvement. Is this synergistic with exercise? Is it replacing exercise? Probably not, but so a lot more to be done here, but super interesting data to look at.
All right. We'll probably have you on again. And it's June 24th or so that they're going to present that BELIEVE trial, which is, again, bimagrumab, which through a few different mechanisms gets down to basically blocking myostatin. It's, what does it say here? It targets activin type 2 receptors and then thereby inhibiting ligands like myostatin as well. So there's these things, similar pathways, but we'll see what happens in the end. Yeah. Very good. Well, go follow Dr. Grant on Instagram, and you can go, I'll put his link to his blog where he talks all sorts of stuff about even scales. We did that podcast. I'll post those other podcasts that he's been on to learn more about the whole fat-free mass, lean mass loss in these medicines. Share this with a friend, family member who is concerned about weight and kind of interested in the muscle stuff here. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.